In the run-on sentence that is the second statement in Paul's first letter, that's to the Galatians, and what is now called Galatians 1:8, as if it were an independent verse to be deployed however someone would want, but it's really just part of a run-on sentence. Paul wrote, but from Chi, to the contrary from Allah, if in we emes, or from E, a messenger, anagelos, out of ek, heaven, aronos, might convey a healing messenger or beneficial message, euangelizo, to you, su, which is approximate or contrary to what hos para we delivered as a beneficial messenger, euangelizo, to you, su, then a curse, an anathema, exists. Hear me. Galatians 1:8. Paul is saying that, yeah, we've been a messenger from heaven. Now, the messenger from heaven would be a fellow, you might have heard of him. You probably haven't heard him by this name, unless you're a listener routinely to this program. But an individual known as Yahweh, who happens to be God, set apart a part of himself in diminished form to represent in a corporeal way his word to us, naming such manifestation Yahusha, meaning Yahweh saves. He was the messenger out of heaven. And Paul is saying that even if a messenger out of heaven, that would be Yahusha, corrupted to Jesus Christ by moronic Christians, differs, and he does differ according to this, that message and messenger is a curse in Pauline doctrine. Now, I know Christians aren't very smart. I know Christians don't like to think. I know that faith is about not thinking and not having to think. But a messenger out of heaven with a different message than Paul's gospel of grace, the candidate there is only one. That's Yahusha. That's the corporeal manifestation of Yahweh. That's the very manifestation of God that you claim to have established your religion upon. He is the only messenger out of heaven that conveys something different to what Paul is conveying. This is Paul against God. And Paul is laying down the gauntlet, saying, but to the contrary, if we or a messenger out of heaven might convey a healing message or beneficial messenger to you, which is approximate or contrary to what we, the Paul team, delivered, then a curse exists. Well, there's only one individual that came from heaven that delayed a message that was contrary to Paul's, and that is the Messiah Yahusha, errantly known to Christians as Jesus Christ, which means that it is Paul v. Jesus. That's obvious when you read Paul's letters and you read Yahusha's statements that it was always that way. But now it's in your face. So if you've been beguiled by Christianity, what are you going to do about it? The author of half of your New Testament has just declared that a curse is on the individual that you think founded your religion. You got a problem. Now, using Shaul, which was Paul's given name, in this way, the adversary who knew him by the name Shaul has brought a curse upon himself and upon all that are in league with him. Yahweh announced this sentence in the Garden of Eden nearly 6,000 years ago, 4,000 years after this was written, telling us that the serpent would be cursed for having beguiled Yahweh by corrupting his testimony. So, the curse of the adversary that the adversary brought on himself has now found its way into Paul's preamble. By writing this, Paul's intent was to render any competitive message moot, especially Yahusha's and his disciples. He wanted his audience to join him in condemning his foes, God and God's spokesman. This is akin to Islam, where Allah warns Muslims to be ever ready to attack, even to slander and kill all who would besmirch the Islamic God's reputation by telling the truth. So while Allah is Satan, the wannabe God prevails by labeling his opponents satanic, and thereby confusing the feeble-minded. This duplicity confuses people because most cannot fathom why Satan would oppose Satan, as he appears to do in both Christianity and Islam. But the moment a person considers who Satan is and contemplate what Satan wants, the answer becomes obvious. Satan does not want to be known as the devil or the adversary, but instead as the Lord.
If I call you a liar, what's the first thing you're going to tell me? I'm not a liar. No, I'm not. No, I'm not a liar. I'm not. So that's the same thing.
Yeah, what you've got here is creating confusion. It's someone accusing those who would hold him accountable for his lies, liars. That's essentially what happens. So when someone like myself says Paul is the liar because he has established his message in conflict with Yahusha's and Yahweh's, then the person who would judge between the two to say, well, who's telling the truth? Is it Paul or God? And what that individual will do is, because they don't want it to be a referendum between Paul and God, which is where the referendum actually exists, they will instead slander me or you for bringing this message. So say, no, the problem is you person who would dare speak against Paul. And if you speak against Paul and the Christian message, a curse is on you because Paul told us so. And so they slander anyone who would bring the truth. And in effect, what they're doing is saying that Satan is the adversary of their message. And he truly is. Because Satan doesn't want to be the adversary. And so a message that properly presents Islam and Christianity is adversarial to Islam and Christianity. And yet the foolish are easily beguiled because they are not rational. They're unwilling to say, wait a minute, the only contrarian message to Paul at this time from heaven was delivered by Yahusha. And yes, that message is completely different than Pauline Christianity. Compare the Sermon on the Mount to Paul's letter to the Galatians. Just set them side by side. They're exact opposites. So one of the two of them lied. They're in conflict with one another. And here Paul is saying that a curse exists on the opposition, which is in this case God. And so this notion that Christianity and Islam are opposed to Satan is absolutely what Satan desires. He's opposed to Satan. He doesn't want to be the adversary. He wants to be the Lord God. He wants to be seen as the Lord God. And the only way for that to happen is to attack the label of Satan, the adversary. The Satan, ha Satan, means the adversary in Hebrew. He has to go to war with that moniker, with that depiction. And to replace that perception of his nature with one considerably more favorable, more elevated, more in charge, more worthy of veneration, one more fearsome. The Lord. But it's pure duplicity, although very effective duplicity. Satan wants to be worshipped as if he were God. Therefore, it's perfectly rational, even clever, for Satan to oppose his adversarial title in texts which not only present him as the Lord and as God, but which at the same time undermine the credibility of the only real God, Yahweh, his nature, his testimony, and his covenant. When the verb euangelizo is changed to a proper noun and becomes gospel, as is the case with the King James Version, we're left with nothing but the curse. It reads, But though we, or an angel from heaven, may preach any other gospel unto you than that which we have preached unto you, let him be cursed. By the way, there is no angels in heaven. None. Angelos does not mean angel. It means messenger. Period. The Greek term angelos means messenger. It is a translation of the Hebrew term malach, which means messenger. There are no angels. No such thing as an angel. The whole concept of an angel is a Christian myth. There are spiritual messengers. He did not write angel. And Paul did not write gospel. That's a religious term, bearing no resemblance whatsoever to the actual word that Paul wrote. Paul's words are damning, to be sure. But the King James, claiming to be the inerrant and authorized word of God, makes a mockery of them. In this verse, the authors of the King James changed Allah to but, as if Shaul selected D to begin the sentence. They ignored Chi, which means and then translated in as through, as opposed to the preposition if. They transliterated, which means they replicated the sound of agelos as angel instead of translating, which is to replicate the meaning of it as messenger. Continuing to add to the impropriety of the King James Version, they added the word preach when there's absolutely no basis for the verb in the Greek text. Then they included the words any other without any textual justification, and they replaced the first euangelizo with a verb and with the noun gospel in the second. Same word. Then the King James arbitrarily added unto, than, and that without any textual support. They included a second we, rendered the second euangelizo, not as gospel this time, but have preached, inadequately representing the word rather than replacing it. They added another unto without textual support. They included the pronoun him as if Shaul had written it. But since there is very little association between what Paul said and what the King James Version published, it's easy to see how people have been misled by their product. Now, for those of you who hold up the King James Version and said this is the inerrant word of God, not only does it include a New Testament that God did not inspire, not only does it contain letters that were written by a man who admitted to being demon-possessed, who was contrary to everything God had to say in Paul, the translations of Paul's letters aren't even remotely, even within a hemisphere of being consistent with what he wrote. If what Paul wrote, for example, was inerrant, then these translations are wholly errant. And if the translations are inerrant, then what Paul wrote was wholly errant. Oops. So that is fresh in your mind. Paul actually wrote, but to the contrary, if we are a messenger out of heaven, might convey a healing messenger or a beneficial message to you, which is approximate or contrary to, beyond or positioned alongside what we have delivered as a beneficial messenger and announced as a healing message to you, then a curse with a dreadful consequence exists. If you have disposed of your King James for a New American Standard Bible, the version which claims to present a literal rendering of the oldest Greek and Hebrew manuscripts, I am sorry to say that it isn't much better. It is as incongruent as the King James Version, and obviously little more than a revision of its more popular predecessor. It reads, But even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to what we have preached to you, he is to be accursed. Swell. So much for literal. Again, it was inappropriate to translate agelos angel. But the crux of the issue here is the verb euangelizo was rendered preach to you a gospel in the first time it appears, which is wrong linguistically. And then the second time, the exact same verb appears, it is simply rendered preach, as if euangelizo was one of many Greek words for speak. And it isn't. Recognizing that the vaulted and acclaimed Nestle Allen interlinear reads, but even if we or messenger from heaven might tell good message to you from what good message we ourselves told to you, curse let there be. The New International Version is equally distant from the Greek, but even if we or an angel from heaven should preach a gospel other than the one we preached to you, let him be eternally condemned. The common dissimilarity from the words Paul actually penned, combined with their similarity to one another, affirms that these translations were actually revisions of one another. And that's a profound truth, that as a Christian reading a Bible ought to come to recognize. The fact is that almost all English translations are revisions of prior mistakes. And not corrections of prior mistakes, just simply revisions. You see, if you go back in history, the Torah was written in Hebrew. But the Catholic Church hated Hebrew. And it loved Latin. That was Roman. And so they took, rather than translating, Jerome didn't translate the Hebrew Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. No, he translated Greek translations of the Hebrew testimony that God had provided for us. And then the Latin was translated into English and revised. It's languages apart. Once again, it was inappropriate. Even in the New International Version, to translate this the way they did. The Nestle Allen, for the most part, got it right. But the New International Version, they were as duplicitous as was the King James, as was the New American Standard Bible, all collectively promoting lies. And the history of this is that Roman Catholicism is the basis of Christianity. Well, even if you're a Protestant today, you need to understand that Christianity as a religion was created and promoted by Roman Catholics. They were Romans. And they were disgusting individuals. The fathers of the Christian church are revolting. But they were in love with the language of Rome. The disgusting kingdom of and empire of Rome, which was Latin. So they didn't want Hebrew. They didn't want Greek. So they took the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms as they were written in Hebrew, found translations which were extraordinarily crude and inaccurate and inconsistent, called the Septuagint, which it's just to think that there was one Septuagint would be naive. There were, by this time, there were so many variations in the Septuagint. It's kind of like the these translations of the Christian New Testament. They're so divergent that you could put 1,000 scholars on this project for 1,000 years and never come to a common denominator. And it was that Jerome translated into Latin. And then he took the Greek texts and he translated them into Latin. And then when it came time to have an English version, because the church only wanted to maintain the Latin translations, because that way no one could hold them accountable. No one could stand up and say, wait a minute, your church canon, your church rules, your church teachings, your papal decrees are in conflict with your own acknowledged translations of the New Testament. So, to keep people ignorant, they kept the only legal Bibles in Latin, even though very few people spoke Latin after a while when Rome fell. So then what you have is finally in English, John Wycliffe dared to translate the New Testament of the Latin Vulgate into a precursor of English. And for that, they had every copy they could find torn up, the Roman Catholic Church did, dug up his body, desecrated his body, labeled him a heretic for translating the Christian New Testament into a language people actually spoke. But a few copies of John Wycliffe's translation existed, and ultimately it progressed through a series of revisions. You had the Bishop's Bible and the Geneva Bible and the like. Tyndale had a translation, but they weren't really translations. They were just simply revisions of what John Wycliffe had created. But along the way, there was a realization that the claims of the kings of Europe that they had divine right to rule was undermined, because there is no godly edict giving kings the right to rule. None. And so some of the English translations, like the Geneva Bible, pointed it out. And it was such a threat to the monarchy that King Iams, as he was known at the time, had Sir Francis Bacon, a Rosicrucian and therefore a Satanist, come up with a revised translation that was called the KJV, the Authorized King James Version, for the express purpose of reestablishing the myth that kings had the right to rule. And it became fabulously popular, but it wasn't an independent translation. It was simply a revision of the Geneva Bible, which was very popular at the time. And each of the English translations thereafter, the American Standard, New American Standard, International Version, New International Version, and the most recent, the New Living Translation, all of them are nothing more than revisions. Because if they revised it to the point of creating an accurate and new translation from scratch, it wouldn't be recognizable. There would be no Jesus Christ. There'd be no church, for example. There'd be no cross. And so if you can imagine a book that's no longer called a Bible, that no longer has Gospels, that no longer has a New Testament, that no longer has a reference to church or to Christian or to Jesus or to Christ, that doesn't use Lord. And if you can imagine that, then that's what an accurate translation would be. But it would be so enormously different than what people are accustomed to, no one would buy it. There's not a pastor that would recommend it, and not a Christian who would buy it, even though it was vastly more accurate. But it's familiarity that sells. That's why, you know, Nike, for example, pays millions of dollars to athletes to wear its swoosh, just so the swoosh becomes familiar. And so an accurate translation would never sell. They don't exist. None can be recommended. These are all revisions of one another, and they are all completely incongruous with the original text. The further you look back in terms of manuscripts, the more differences you will find between the oldest manuscripts and what is found in the pages of Christian Bibles. And the more recent the translation, the more egregious it is. There is no more fanciful, novelized account than the New Living Translation that is so popular among Christians today. The New King James is even worse than the King James, which is horrendous. So, turning to the NILT, the New Living Translation, which already we have learned is nothing more than a loose paraphrase under the slogan, "The Truth Made Clear," reads, "Let God's curse fall on anyone, including us, or even the angel from heaven, who preaches a different kind of good news than the one we preach to you." Well, preaches, good news, would have been a slightly more accurate translation of the first occurrence of euangelizo, demonstrating that the words themselves are irrelevant to their presentation. They translated the second euangelio differently, this time without any reference to different kind or good news, even though the same exact word appeared twice in the actual text. Further, the sentence order in the New Living Translation was reversed, and God's title was added without any textual support. In so doing, the passage now infers that God is the one cursing a specific individual, as opposed to the contrarian message existing as a curse. Christian theologians are deliberately being inconsistent because gospel and good news are central to their theology. Christendom is based upon these concepts. It is as critical and errant as the doctrine of the Trinity in this regard. We find the following in Jerome's blend of old Latin manuscripts that translated Greek text into the Latin of the Roman Empire during the emergence of Roman Catholicism as the following. "But if anyone, even we ourselves, or an angelus from heaven, were to evangelize other than the one that we evangelizimus to you, let him be anathema." Once again, we find evidence that Jerome wasn't to blame for the corruption of euangelizo to gospel. But he was to blame for the subsequent treatment of the Catholic heretics due to his personalizing of this curse. This became the justification for torturing those who said, "No, this is wrong." These translations all affirm that Paul wanted his rivals cursed. And by his definition, his opponents were those whose message was contrary to his own. So as we discover, as we make our way through this letter, Paul will come to include Yahweh and his prophets, including Yahusha and his disciples, as those who are opposed to him and are cursed by him. While they all spoke with one voice, their message was contrary to Paul's. And that, folks, is the bottom line. Now, repeating himself, but this time slipping from first person plural to singular, to underscore the fact that this Benjamite was a lone wolf among men, we are left to question the motivation for the duplication. And with Paul so overly fixated on his rivals, so early in his first letter, do you suppose the reason he didn't mention them by name was because he had already done so? Had he done so, his credibility would have been destroyed? The Nestle Allen McReynolds interlinear reads as follows, and I'm going to share that with you before I share a more literal translation of the text. It reads, As we have said before, and now again I say, if some you tells good message from what you took, along curse let be. Now, I know that sounds illiterate. I'm just reading what the McReynolds and Interlinear associated with the Nestle Island presents. It presents, as we have said before, and now say again, I say, if some you tells good message from what you took along, curse let be. The basis for their translation was as follows. As we have said before, and even just now, also say. In fact, it's also I say. If someone delivers a helpful messenger or communicates a useful message to you, contrary or in opposition to that which you received, it shall be a curse with a dreadful consequence. This is now Galatians 1:9. I will read through that once again, and we will talk about the implications in the last 5 minutes of this program as we conclude for today, when Shattering Mist resumes after the commercial break. Repeats himself. He says, as we, and who knows who we is, because at this point, Paul didn't have a posse. He didn't have any comrades. He was out there all by himself. As we have said before, and even just now, also, I say. Now, he didn't say before. This is his first letter. And it wasn't we. It's always been I. So first he begins, as we have said before, and even just now, also I say. By the way, but I say is the telltale sign that Paul was a consummate liar in conflict with Yahweh, because you won't find a single prophet speaking for Yahweh in the whole of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, whoever once says, but I say, ever. But just now, also, I say, if someone delivers a euangelizo, which is helpful messenger, or communicates a useful message. So delivers a helpful messenger, or communicates a useful message. It's a verb. To you, contrary to or in opposition to, para, close to, but yet besides, which is approximate to, near, beyond, greater than, or positioned alongside. That which you received, paralambano, it shall exist, this is emi, it's I wish or command that it shall exist. It was in the present tense, which means that the state currently exists and that it will continue for an undisclosed period. The active voice means that the subject, Paulos, who is the speaker, is actively engaged in bringing about the curse. And in the imperative mood, which serves either as a command or an expression of the speaker's desire or both. It shall be a curse with a dreadful consequence, an anathema. Galatians 1:9. Since this is Paul's first letter, the as we have said before is little more than a reference to the previous sentence, something he makes clear by way of RT simultaneously and immediately thereafter. As a result, since Paulos is writing exclusively under his own name, we must consider what he has been trying to accomplish by using we, and then ponder why he felt it was necessary to transition back to I. Who were his partners, and why at times did he exclude them? It is telling, therefore, that Galatians 1:6 begins, I am amazed, first person singular, present tense, but then transitions to we delivered, first person plural, past tense, in Galatians 1:8. Paul's recent visit to Galatia was with Barnabas, according to Acts, perhaps accounting for the prior and plural message delivery. But in the short period between the Jerusalem summit and the time this letter was dictated, Barnabas and Shaul had a heated argument and they split up, accounting for the present singular perspective. At least that would be the case had Galatians 1:9 not included we and I in immediate succession. Also interesting, Paul will take a mean-spirited swipe at Barnabas before this letter is through. As is the case with everything Paul writes, he never bothers to explain the nature of his argument. All he says is that I'm always right and everyone else is always wrong. As such, even if Paul's opinions were right, without a basis in fact, it wouldn't be helpful. Thus far, and indeed throughout Paul's letters, we will be exposed to Paul's opinions, and we will be appraised of his attitude, but nothing else. So, for example, when he is saying that anybody tells you anything different than what I tell you, there's a curse, he hasn't even told us what he's going to tell us yet. And when he does, he will provide absolutely no evidence for its veracity. Just spew out his doctrine, his opinions. Now, it's the antithesis of Yahusha, who explained his identity, who explained his purpose by citing the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Evidence and reason. Here is the cause, I am the consequence. I mean, it was all laid out for us. Here is the basis of who I am and what was said about me and how to come to understand me and how to capitalize on what I'm offering. It's all there in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Well, Paul never makes his case. It's always just a series of opinions that Paul promotes. And so how are we even to know the nature of this conflict or with whom it is being based? It's all part of the nebulous deception that is Pauline Christianity.